Hello there, and you're very welcome to Terrace Talk. We see Fogarty, as usual, with you. And as tonight's recording is pre-recorded, we won't be taking any telephone calls. But I can tell you, I have a cracking program lined up for you, fascinating program, because my guest this evening is a man whose life story epitomizes, in the most inspiring of ways, the old adage, from rags to riches. Born and bred in the tough inner city slums of Slumberhill in Dublin, he is now chairman of the Glencullen Group, annual turnover of, would you believe, £250 million. A wonderful story. He has a great love for sport and can now even claim to be half a Kerryman. Bill Cullen, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk and to Radio Kerry.
And I'm delighted to have had the honour of being half a Kerryman, Rishi. Thank you very much.
And of course, Bill, since you launched your book, it's a long way from penny apples. Your whole life, really, for the general public, has become public as such, hasn't it?
It has, and that's it's probably something that I didn't really expect. I wrote the book as a tribute, really, to my mother and father and my grandmother. That's really what it was. It was also a reaction, I have to say, to Angela's Ashes, which I found very depressing. And I thought that Frank McCourt's phrase that the only thing worse than a miserable childhood was a miserable Irish childhood. And I have to say that I took umbrage at that, because the community that I was raised in, we may have been poor, but that just meant we had no money. But they were a loving community. They were parents who loved and nurtured us. And that's what I decided to put down in the book. I didn't expect it to have the success it has, because it's number one in Australia as we speak. It's gone very well in England. And it's back as number one again this Christmas here in Ireland. So we launched in America in February, and I never expected that. And I suppose it's fair to say that, yes, I did expose my whole background and everything else in the book. And I've no regrets about that, because I've never hidden it at any time. My roots are my roots.
Well, Bill, I must say that my own mother-in-law, who's 92 years of age, had this online. She raced through the nearly 400 pages of it in 3 days, and she enjoyed it down to the ground. Now, the one thing that came through in it for me, and I must say this, just before Ireland left for the World Cup, I went to Dublin. I interviewed Mick Byrne, the Irish physiotherapist,
yes,
who has achieved great fame in his own right. And I had a beautiful interview with Mick. And he came from the inner city also, in Dublin. And the one thing that came through to me, and I think it came out through your book, was how religion played a big part in your parents' lives.
Ah, yeah, that was probably the biggest difference of all between Frank McCourt's family and ours. My mother, father and grandmother never drank. They had their pioneer pins all their lives. I had my pioneer pin till I was into my mid-30s. From the time I made my Holy Communion at 6 years of age, to as long as I lived in my mother's house, I got Mass and Communion every morning. And the discipline of religion was huge for those the people of that time. And they always had faith. My grandmother, Weezy, on a Saturday evening, would have me count her few bob after a week's taking selling the fish on the streets. And she'd put the couple of quid in the one jar for the rent and the other jar for the light bill and so on. And whatever she was left it with, she'd put it in an envelope. And we'd take it over and give it to the nuns in the church across the road. And I remember saying to her, why are we giving this money to the nuns? And she said, well, someone, they give it out to the poor. And I said, well, Gran, are we not poor? Ah, she said, someone, look at you. Shoes on your feet, clothes on your back, roof over your head, 2 meals a day, and a mammy and daddy that loves you. We're not poor, she said, we're very rich. And yeah, that epitomises the time.
Is that sense of religion that was there in those times, and in my own father's and mother's times for that matter, is it gone today, do you think?
It is, of course. And, you know, the scandals of the clerics, that's very at the front of all the papers at the moment, is probably what's undermined the whole structure of religion. And I think the last page in the book would indicate that too, which was our own Bishop of Kerry. I don't want to say anything about it, other than it really shocked the older people of the generation that came up in the 40s and the 50s. And it wasn't as a man committed any really bad sin compared to what we're hearing about now. And yet, I can honestly say my father never recovered from getting that news of Bishop Casey. Never recovered from it. He died within 2 or 3 months. And I always say he died resenting the fact that he had put so much into religion. And I did try to talk to him and say that, you know, you have to forgive that. You know, you can't take bitterness with you. But I don't think he did. I don't think he came out of that.
What was, looking back now at your childhood, staying with the religious side of it, what was would the rosary be said in the home? By the way, there was 14 children in the family.
That's right.
Yeah, 14 children in the family. What would the rosary be said? And I want to emphasise the importance of religion in those times in relation to today.
When it started, that, you know, I got up at 5:30 every morning, with you, and still do. That's a habit that was ingrained in me because I got 6 o'clock mass every morning with my grandmother, and myself and my 7 brothers were all altar boys all our life from the time we were 6 till we were about 16, and there were 3 churches in our area, and we'd be getting called from one to the other to facilitate priests working as altar boys. So that was the start. You always said your angels at 12 and 6 o'clock, always, and after tea every evening we all kneel down around the table and we said a rosary every night at my mother's house. Anyone who was there, bump, you stopped at 7 and you knelt down and said a rosary, and you never went to bed without kneeling at the side of your bed.
Even though you were born in what you described as a tenement, it appeared to me, reading the book, that you had a very, very happy childhood. In relation to, as you say, the Limerick story, your childhood and your growing up appeared to be happy.
Somebody says that, you know, we only look back and see the happy times, and maybe that's true, because it obviously rains an awful lot in Ireland, but I don't notice it. And I suppose that comes from my mother and my father. They were very dynamic people. My mother was gone from 5:30 in the morning till 2 o'clock the next morning, and I can still see her cooking at the stove, serving meals with a baby wrapped within a shawl around her breast, maybe on her breast, ironing the ironing board there and an iron on it. And she'd sit down in a couple of minutes, she'd be knitting and sewing buttons on shorts and trousers and all the rest of it. And she'd be going like that till 2 o'clock in the morning. She'd often fell asleep in the chair and up again the next morning. So what I'm saying is, it was a dynamic household. We never got time. We weren't let sit around. You all had something to do. If you weren't doing your exercise, you were helping the kids, you were out. I was down selling black market tickets in the evenings. I was rearing pigs, collecting the feeding, as we called it, from the slops, boiling that, cleaning them out. So you were always going. You didn't have time to stop and be sad. It never happened.
Your father never drank.
No, and my mother.
And your mother. But your father in particular had a reason, because he had seen too much of it himself.
And I didn't discover that till we buried him.
Till you buried him, and you describe that. Now, he did never drink. He had a reason that he didn't drink. But if you talk to us about him not drinking, why he didn't drink, in relation to the drinking culture of today.
Well, I discovered after my father died from my elder sister that my father's mother had died in her early 40s of the drink, and my father had seen obviously the result of drinking in his home as he grew up, and that turned him off it completely. And not alone did he never drink, but he never went into a pub in his life. And when he was off on excursions with his company, all the lads would go in for their meal and a pint in the pub. My father would sit in the bus with his rosary beads. So maybe he was over the top in terms of religion, and that's okay with me too. But then, when you look at where we are today, and I went into a school very recently down south, and I was talking to some of the kids a few weeks ago. And when I walked into the big auditorium that I was speaking from, two things struck me. Number one, there were 8 huge advertisements in the room for alcohol. Number two, the speaker before me was a man from a drinks company, and when he finished his talk, he said that there was one of these small bottles of spirits for everyone in the audience, all of whom were college students. And I find that very depressing, I have to say today. I'm very disappointed that the GAA have encouraged the drink culture by embracing endorsements and sponsorship from the drinks company. And when I see an ad on television that shows the hurler having his drink to make him achieve and succeed, I think that those images are very wrong for our young people. And maybe it's my background, maybe it's the fact that I didn't drink, but I realised that smoking and drinking was not going to be of any good to me if I wanted to be a champion soccer player, which was my goal at the time. And we want sport to encourage the young people, and I think that the drinks culture that's growing so fast in Ireland today is something we all have to recognise is a huge problem, and we have to do something about it.
Bill, there's a lot of talk, and talking to parents, the one thing they'll come down on is the extension in the drinking hours by the government, even though you'd speak to politicians and they'd tell you that has nothing to do with it. But I've been talking to parents, I'm a parent myself, and I firmly believe that instead of lengthening the hours, they should have probably shortened them. What would you do to cull that fierce culture of drink that's there at the moment, and it is there, sweeping the country?
Well, I think the advertising has to be banned, the way cigarette advertising has been banned. That's number one. I agree with you that the length and the license hours has helped nobody. It hasn't helped publicans in the terms of cost of it, and it hasn't helped young people who are now going out at 10 o'clock at night, when we used to be going home. I know, as long as I lived in my mother's house till I was 22, I had to be in before midnight. That was the golden rule. Otherwise, my father would be out looking for me. And they were the rules. And you don't apply today. Young kids go out at 10 and 11 o'clock now and they won't come home till dawn.
Are things going to get better or worse?
I have great faith in the young people of Ireland, Louise. I think they're highly educated now. They're very intelligent. They're far more confident than we were growing up as young people. And I'd like to think that through the schools, that's where the difference will be made. And I spoke in a school in Killarney today. And I think in Killorgan, and you might have thought that I did emphasise this point, that, you know, if they want to succeed in the way they really want to succeed, drink doesn't play any part in that. It's something that's going to hold them back, and it's something that's going to undermine their ability to achieve.
You were very impressed by the Killorgan Intermediate School.
I was. I've been in a few schools in Kerry's, and I have to say that the intermediate school in Killorgan, wonderful staff, wonderful young people, and we gave out a lot of prizes there for the achievers. And it's a joy for me to go into schools because, as you know from the book, I was expelled from school when I was 13. So I didn't get the privilege of enjoying what they're enjoying now. And I think it's great to see young people in harmony with the teachers, working toward their goals and achieving. And that's why I say it's a pity that drink could undermine what we're actually working so hard to develop.
And of course they produced the great bike Frank Russell. That's a kind of a reflection in the school when they can produce a man of that class. Well, really, it's a reflection on his club long range,
right,
and on the school and the teachers.
That's right,
it?
And I said how much sport plays a part in the whole achievement of life, that sports teach you determination, it teaches you teamwork, and it teaches you to be self-reliant. So all those things come from sport, and sport is an integral part of growing up, and it's great to see what the Killorgan School has with this all-weather pitch. You know,
you gave that motivational speech to the children behind them, the school children today now. Do you think there's enough of that done in the schools? Maybe is there a lack of people like yourself that who have reached the top of the tree and gone through it all and came from the bottom up? Is there enough of that going on in the schools of Ireland?
I suppose it's something the schools themselves have to encourage. I'm not going out knocking on doors really to schools to say, hey, can I come down and do something? I am getting, as a result of the book, I'm getting calls from schools to say, will you come down and talk to our people? And I try to do that and fit it in my schedule. And because we have a home here in Killarney, I'm prepared to do it anywhere in Kerry, and I have. I think it's great for the children to see people who are, in their eyes, successful in the context of business and all. Having us down to talk. I think that's a great mentorship for them. I think it can inspire young people. I feel that from where I came from in particular, I actually have a responsibility to do that. Because, again, in the book, you'll see where some people were very, very good to me and helped me along the way. In particular, I always mention this story in 1956. When I was writing into the papers to try and get a job from the ads, I wrote in 700 times in 1956 without getting a response because of my address in a no-go area. And I expressed my frustration to a social worker in the boys' club who let me use his address of Vernon Avenue, Clontarf, Dublin 3. And the first ad I replied to at that address, got a response, got an interview, got the job, and 8 years later was managing director of the company. So I'm just saying that the nurturing and the mentorship in the school and for young people is very important. And I'm always prepared to, in turn now, give back the benefits that I've received from that mentorship to young people here in Ireland today.
You were out in the streets of Dublin at 6 years of age, selling, and the buke, as you call it yourself, covers all the aspects of it, and we can't go into that, but there's one aspect of it that we'll have to cover, because I might have bought an orange off you, I don't know, but many Kerry people, they might have even bought programmes off you.
Because
in around 1955, around that, the middle 50s, you were selling, and I suppose buying around Croke Park. Tell us about that part of your life and how it came on and what happened about fellas buying the boxes and things like that. I thought that was very good.
Well, Croke Park became a business institution for us and the family.
Incidentally, nearly built by Kerry, Croke Park.
Without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. All the Kerry people go up there. I think they go every Sunday practically. That's the way it seems. Every time you go to Croke Park, Kerry are playing. Yeah. But I was in Croke Park for every match from 1949 to 1961. and hardly saw any of them, Guishy, because that's what I was doing. My mother first, we started selling fruit outside Gill's Pub on the corner of Russell Street, which goes down to Crow Park. That's at the North Circular Road end. And then we got the idea of, well, we used to finish up when the match started and wait till the crowds come out. Then we got the idea of going into the crowds with the boxes, and we did. We were able to get in by the stewards, and we sold the fruit inside the ground, which was new in 1950. We sold programmes as well outside. And we then went and got the empty orange boxes from all the dealers who were selling all around Crow Park and into the back of Hill 16 with them, and we sold them for the lads to sell on for 2 shillings each. At the end of the match, of course, we'd collect all the broken boxes, because after half a dozen carrymen standing them for an hour and a half, they were really gone, and we used to sell that for firewood in the following week. We also had a ladder at the railway end, and me and the brothers, we'd take turns going up there, and we'd let you up the ladder for half a crown, and we could fit 119 men on the railway end wall. So the whole thing was an income-earning day, and I can remember going home on Sunday nights in those days, and we'd have earned about 20 quid, and that would be my father's wages for 2 weeks, or 2 months. You know,
you so mentioned 119.
Yes.
How much a head?
Two and six a head.
2 and 6.
Do you
a
want
head.
To know how much that was? That was about 15 quid. Yeah. Just from the. You know, we'd buy the ladder for a pound.
Come here. It was most Kerry, of course. The '50s for Kerry, of course, was a wonderful time, because in 1953 they won the All Ireland, 1955 they won the All Ireland, 1959 they won the All Ireland, and they were beaten in 1958. And it was so. You must have. You listen to me. You must be very thankful to Kerry. How difficult were the Kerry fellas to get a bob off a bill? Were they good to bargain?
They weren't good to bargain. No. Once the Kerry people got up to Dublin, they were soft touches. I have to say that. Or put it another way. They might be tight enough in Kerry, but when they get up to the big smoke, they were very generous. And I'll tell you this much, I used to sell the Kerry colours, but because we sold newspapers, and you got all the photographs of the team out of the newspapers that weren't sold, we used to stick Mick O'Connell on our rosettes, and I could get an extra tuppence or threepence for my rosette and Mick O'Connell's picture stuck on it than the fellow who didn't have his picture stuck on it. And the Kerry people would give you a penny or twopence for yourself, I have to say that, when they're buying the fruit off you. It was as if it was a big day out. They knew they were going to win. They were feeling very generous, and she'd give the youngful a couple of pence. And that's the way it used to work.
And of course, you have a great love for Gaelic football, of course. Mm. And I do know that Michael Connell is one of you. He gets very lovely mention in your book, and he's one of your favourites. Football, Gaelic football has played a big part in your life in relation to following it, and Croke Park and everything where you were right up near it.
Yeah, and I went to school near it, and I saw Mick O'Connell playing his first game as a minor in Crow Park. And even then, you could see the elegance of the man. You could see the style of the man, and you could see the huge preparation and hard work he'd put into his game with his pinpoint passing. And it's fair to say that he is described as the prince of Gaelic football. There were far more tougher men around, and I suppose the match I remember mostly was the Galway match, when I saw Sean Purcell and Frank Stockwell. You'll tell me now who they were playing. It was 55 or 56.
56 national.
Against Cork.
Against Cork in
that's
the 1956 final.
That's the one. And that day, Frank Stockwell Cork scored 2 goals and 5 points. I don't know whether anyone's done that. What's that? 11 points in one match. Yeah. And he won the match on their own that day. That was a great day. And I saw the Wexford team won that year as well in the hurling.
56, the day that Hart Foley saved
exactly,
shot.
From Christine Ring.
And Christine Ring was at Incline.
Correct, I remember. And I saw that. That was a bit I did see, but yeah. I heard the roars and the shouts. I looked to see what happened on Christine Ring. The ball had gone back up the pitch, and he walked right up to the goalkeeper and shook his hand.
Do you still get a chance to go to Croke Park?
Yeah, but it's different now. You're up in the corporate boxes, and it's all very relaxed, and you're having a meal and all that. So it's not the same fun as being on the terraces, in my mind.
And of course, when we mentioned Croke Park, we are deviating so much now. I must ask you about Ireland didn't get the 2008 European Cup. The Croke Park wouldn't open up for them. And will it come? Should it come?
Well, I have to say that when you look at what the government and my north side friend Bertie Ahern has done in the context of the millions that he's given to Croke Park, I felt that he felt that he would make the gesture themselves and open it up. And they haven't. And you kind of feel now, well, maybe he should have given them the money on condition that they opened it up. But just go back, just turn the clock back to 1955, Weezy, and I had got a scholarship to O'Connell Schools, which was a great source of pride to my mother. And I was captain of the Gaelic football and hurling teams in O'Connell's under 14, but I also played soccer for Home Farm, because soccer was the inner city game. We'd no fields. So when you're playing on the street, you had to keep the ball on the deck, so we played soccer. So I appeared in a picture of the under 14 team winning the school boys' leagues, and I was expelled from O'Connell's for being a traitor to my country and my school. So that didn't adhere me to the GAA, and I still respect their position on that in those times. But the country and Ireland and the Celtic Tiger, we've gone an awful long way. We have the peace and prosperity with agreement with Northern Ireland. And I think at this stage, every man in the country should be saying that it's time to open it up. And it's a pity it wasn't done before now, when we might have had the World Cup 2008 here in Ireland.
You've been a high-powered businessman, Bill, and you'll be well capable of doing your sums very quick in your head, which you could do even since you were 4 or 5 years of age.
Right.
Because it's one part of the book that I enjoyed, how you could tot up figures.
The writing machine, still do.
I'd imagine that financially, Croke Park will have to open up. Will it be the financial aspect of it that will eventually open it up?
No.
Should it open up to all sports?
It should open up to all sports. And this is not finance. The people who are making those decisions, Rishi, I respect that it's their culture. It's their heritage. It's their tradition. And that's the way it is. It's going to take time to change that. And I would have thought that time has come, that we are prepared to open up, just as we're opening up our borders to non-nationals. We are now part of the international stage. I said to you earlier on that the Irish have moved up in the social strata. My sister left Ireland in 1959 to go to America. She got a one-way ticket and spent 1 year working for nothing to pay back the ticket to the people who brought her over. Today, the Irish aren't prepared to work in menial tasks, housekeepers. So now we have Filipinos and, as I say, non-nationals coming into the country, and they're prepared to do that. So Ireland has moved up. And in doing that, we should have moved up as well in terms of our generosity of heart and spirit to what we're trying to do on the sports field. And I remember my mother saying to the brother superior of O'Connell's, who expelled me. She didn't believe me. We went up the next morning. I got a hiding offer for when I told her I was expelled. She went up, and eventually the brother superior came out and he said to her, "Yes, he's expelled for playing soccer." And my mother just looked at him and she said, "Well, you know something, sir? I'm delighted that your son has nothing more to do with the likes of you." And that was a very wise words from my mother. She never went to school.
Yeah. Staying with sport before we move on to your business life, there has been a strike in Cork, as you've been reading about lately.
Yeah.
An open strike. Can you see Gaelic players? Would you be for Gaelic players being paid? Our county is falling too much behind in that aspect. Where, looking down the line, 20 years now, Bill, you're a man that'll be able to look down maybe better than any fella. Where do you see Gaelic games being in 20, 30, 40 years' time? And what's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen has started in Cork. The players have to be looked after. When you look at the dedication and the time that goes into preparing to being a sports star on a GAA pitch, you realise that the players have to be motivated, encouraged and rewarded. And that reward structure will go the same way as soccer did. I was offered a 3-year contract with Manchester United in 1960. And I said, "What's the money?" "It's £6 a week, sir." And I said, "That's not enough for me." And the guy looked at me and said, "Well, I didn't say you were getting the £6. He said, "It's £2 for the landlady in Manchester, £2 for your mother in Dublin, and you get, after deductions, £1.11 and 9p. And the point I'm making here is that Georgie Best played for Manchester United for £6 a week, because until 1962, the maximum wage in England was £20 for a footballer. And this was, I'm talking about Charlton and Law and all those guys playing for United. They got £20 a week. Now, that was 1962. In 2002, they're getting £200,000 a week. Now, I think that the Cork situation today is the opening of the door. And I don't see anything wrong with that. And we all know how much money the GAA perhaps make out of it. And yes, it goes into the schools and the kids all over Ireland, and that's great. But there's big money in sport. It'll get bigger and bigger if the facilities are opened up the way they should be, because Croke Park is lying fallow for, 90% of the time?
You touched on Manchester United there about your own sporting career. You played with Home Farland, then you played with Shelburne, and you got an offer to go with United. Had you visions of becoming a top-class soccer player?
No. I suppose the root of it all, Rishi, was I knew I hadn't got the speed. I was a centre-half. And I was big and tall and strong, and I was brave enough to take on them all. But at the end of the day, I played actually in a Central League match in England for 15 minutes, and I never even touched the ball in the 15 minutes. I ran around like a blue arse fly and never touched the ball. Nothing. It was about, you know, 3 paces too fast for me. So I realised at that time that I wasn't going to make it in top class football, and I settled for the motor business. So I came a, became a car salesman. It was the best thing I ever did.
You did, and you stopped for a pound a week as a, as a messenger boy.
And I had to negotiate that. You were only giving me 15 shillings.
You might bring us up to where you are today from when you started getting that pound. An old Irish pound, I presume.
It was, an old Irish pound.
Two tenchely notes, which...
No, it was the pound. Well, you probably only got 17 and 6 after the few bob for the PRSI and what have you. A quick overview of my business career. Well, as I say, I was only at the company 8 years when I was made managing director. How did that happen? I worked harder than anybody else. I picked up more skills than anybody else. And although we were paid to work from 9 to 6, I worked from 6, maybe 7 in the morning till 9 and 10 at night. And I was always ready to do any job to come up. If someone was out sick, bingo, Bill Cullen would do it. And that's what got me to where I was then. I then went out on my own, opened my own dealership, which became the biggest Ford dealership in Ireland. Then I got the opportunity to buy the Smith Group for a pound, provided I was able to find £18 million in finance, which we did. And in the first year, paid £4 million interest when the interest rates were as high as they were. And, you know, probably worried myself many, many times in that period till we got it on the right track. And now we have a very thriving business. And as you said, we're probably turning over €400 million now today.
To those of us, Bill, now who mightn't be able to grasp that amount of money and get our minds around it, what does your business actually comprise of now? Have you business premises all over Ireland, or are you importing cars? Are you selling them? What a lot of
basically,
people mightn't even understand now.
Basically,
what we're talking about.
Basically,
and I might be one of them.
I'm the importer of Renault cars into Ireland,
yeah.
And we sell about 20,000 a year, 22,000 a year. So I import them. We have a 20-acre compound in Rosslare, and the cars are all brought in there and they're prepared and got ready for the customer, and we take them out to 43 Renault dealers all over Southern Ireland. Of those 43 dealerships, we own 6 or 7 of them ourselves, including the biggest one that's up in Liffey Valley in Dublin. And we support all that then with warranty and with service. But our biggest thing that we're doing, we've 80 people working in that whole thing, and there's 1,100 in the 43 network branches around Ireland. Our biggest thing right now is technical training. Because the car is now a mobile computer. There's 146 computers in every motor car we sell today. And we're trying to take mechanics and turn them into computer technicians to be able to look after the servicing of cars today. And we have a technical centre up in Dublin. And it's just been given the accolade of the number one Renault training centre in Europe. Better even than the ones of Renault in France. And we're now going to be training technicians from all over Europe up in Dublin to service Renault cars and maybe other cars as well.
So the car scene is changing every year,
rapidly,
like everything else.
Rapidly,
yeah.
And we have these very fancy premises going up now, as you might have seen. So the customer is going to spend £20,000 on a car today, Rishi. You know, he can walk into a beautiful supermarket spending £2 or £3 on a cake or milk or whatever. And we want that kind of premises. They're really very well-built, modern premises now to buy your cars in, get your finance in, and no delay, drive away today in your new car.
One man, a Killarney man who's a lot of Muslim, who you speak very highly of in your book and helped you along your way, and his family is still working out in Killarney, was Senator Jackie Daly.
God rest him.
And
man.
You mentioned him, you mentioned him about his smoking his pipe and taking
his Dudeen.
He reminds you of the late Morris O'Donoghue, who used to do the same thing. He'd pull the pipe and he'd think.
Yeah.
But you did mention the late Senator Jackie Daly. He helped you, like you said.
Yeah, I met Jackie Daly up in Dublin in 1959, and he was one of the backbone of the Society of the Irish Modern Industry, and I was sent over to stand in for my boss at some important meeting, and I'm the young fella walking in amongst all these motor moguls and all the brains of the industry, and Jackie Daly came over to me, introduced himself and said, you haven't been here before, he says, come on, sit beside me and I'll show you the ropes. And he saw me through a big executive meeting there that day, and we were at the likes of Conn Smith again, Lord Reston, Stephen O'Flaherty, who founded Volkswagen here in Ireland, the very top people in the motor industry in the late 50s. And then he took me off afterwards and dropped me home in his car. I didn't have one in those days. And we became friends. And he used to stay in a hotel up in Dublin, because as a senator, he'd go up to Dublin for the 3 or 4 or 5 days a week. And we'd meet in the evenings, and he'd give me a lot of advice, good advice. And eventually, when I went up on my own, we used to buy and sell cars together. So I became a very staunch friend, great friend of his son, Billy, and all the family here in Killarney. And, you know, I often say Billy is my second brother. I've 7 of them up in Dublin and I've 1 in Killarney. That's how close we became. Great man.
You don't believe in sleeping much, do you?
No. The grandmother always said to us as kids that sleeping is the nearest thing to dying you'll ever do, so don't do too much of it.
But what about the fella that needs his sleep?
Well, you see, everyone needs their sleep, but the facts are you only need a couple of hours what they call rapid eye movement. And if you take 8 hours to get that couple of hours, Rishi, and I can do it in five, I'm still able to go all day just as much as you. So what I say to people who want to sleep less is if you take a minute a week off your alarm clock, in a year's time you'll have slept an hour less. And if you can save an hour a day, you'll save 365 hours a week, a year, which is 10 working weeks. You'll have added on to whatever it is you want to do with those 10 extra working weeks.
And of course, which
so I work harder than anyone else.
I can see that. And that's why you are where you are today, yeah? And that's why you flew home in a helicopter and brought me with you over the Lakes of Killarney. Actually, it was my first time ever looking at the Lakes of Killarney from in the air, even though I'm living here all my life. So it was a fabulous sight. And of course, with your partner, Jackie Levin, you have you won Molly Darcy's. And that brings us on to a whole new area of a topic. Molly Darcy was your grandmother. And you're living in Killarney, and you have actually fallen in love with the whole place.
Yeah, I hitchhiked to Killarney in 1959. Fell in love with the whole place. I went all around Killarney that weekend, and I went back to Dublin and told all my friends in Dublin I discovered paradise. And that journey around Killarney and my first trip will always live in my memory. We went out to Inishfallon, saw what I describe as the oldest university in the world out there. Went on with the Jarvis through the lakes, went up to Mall's Gap, and went over to Kenmare and came back. And had afternoon tea in the Muckross Hotel, when I think Mrs. Randalls would have been there, Kay Randalls, and I fell in love with the whole place. And from that day on, I came back down to Kerry probably every second weekend. We'd hitchhike down on a Saturday just to say Saturday night, Dickie Rock and our Dublin friends and the Glen Eagles, and hitchhike home on Sunday, or get a lift from Jackie Daly, who might be going up to Dublin.
What's so special about Killarney and Kerry?
Well, for me, it's two things. Number one, it's the beauty of the place. I mean, it's just magic. We have a home, as you know, up on Mangerton Mountain, and we're overlooking the lakes, that beautiful view you saw today. And you won't get more tranquility. I rode Penny Apples up on that mountain in August 2001 in 4 or 5 weeks. The tranquility, the serenity of it, getting up at 3 a.m. and writing for 12 hours a day. So to walk through the woods up on Thorpe Mountain, to walk all around, walk over to Derry Cunningham, all those places are magic around Killarney. But the big thing then is the Kerry people. And I think I've said somewhere that the bond between Kerry and Dublin has been created and cemented on the fields of Croke Park. And it has. And you know as well as I do that the Kerry teams, going back all over the years, still have a tremendous relationship and friendship with their opponents on the Dublin side. And on the 2nd of December this year, we had what we have every year, which is the Renault Sports Awards. And we had 4 or 5 of the lads from the Dublin teams in the 70s, as well as we had Mick O'Dwyer and a few of the lads from Kerry. But everyone speaks highly of each other. When you come down to Kerry then here, the wisdom, the wit and the sayings of the Kerry people fascinate me. And I can sit out there in Molly Darcy's talking to Jack O'Sullivan off the mountain, and he'll give me around the houses about what Bertie did and didn't do and how the tribunals are going, and he'll be up to speed on everything.
And of course, a lot of people might know Jackie Levin is a Kerry woman herself. It was only lately I realised.
Did you not
that
know that?
Only lately. Would you believe it? A lot of our listeners now won't know that. So you better explain where she's from.
I will indeed. Jackie is from Ballyduff in North Kerry. And she went to school in Cahersavine. And Mick O'Connell tells the lovely story that he used to like nothing better than to be around Cahersavine on a Friday afternoon. They see the lovely girls coming out of the convent, and he knew Jackie very well. She's the most gorgeous of them all. So there you are. So, and she went up to Dublin when she was 19 or 20. But as I say, since 1979, we've been coming down to Kerry on a regular basis. We built our home here in 1990. And that's it. We feel that we're at home in Kerry much more than anywhere else in the world.
And of course, Molly Darcy's was the Muckross.
Muckross Hotel.
It was the Muckross Hotel, one of the oldest hotels
the
in
oldest,
the country.
The oldest hotel in Killarney.
And one of the oldest in the country.
I don't know whether people realise or not, Rishi, and you mightn't either, but the Muckross Hotel was built as the Herbert Arms by the Herberts who owned Muckross House, just as the Dunraven Arms in the Dare was built by the Lord Dunraven who owned the Dare Manor. And the reason they built the taverns across from the big houses was that they got a bit tired entertaining big visitors and all the servants, So they shifted the servants over to stay in the arms where they had to pay for their lodgings overnight and pay for their drink and food. And that's really what they had done. So the Herbert Arms, it was initially built in 1790.
And of course, then you renamed it Molly Darcy's Pub. And
after my grandmother.
Talk to us about your grandmother, because she had a huge, huge influence in your life.
Molly Darcy was born in 1892 and lived to 1992. She was 100 years old when she died. She was born in a gypsy caravan. She was orphaned out at 10 to a servant family up on Mountjoy Square in Dublin, when they were aristocratic homes, and she became a downstairs maid. Never went upstairs in the 4 years she was in that house. Got married in Dublin, and she had 11 kids, one of which was my mother, obviously. And she lost her husband in his early 40s. He was a baker, and he died of the consumption, as it was called, from the bakery. And she reared her family through both wars. But what I didn't know till 1977, when I bought a house over in Donnybrook, and she asked me where I was living, and I said, "Oh, I'm in Donnybrook in a small by road called Brendan Road that you wouldn't know." She said, "Know it well, Brendan Road." And I didn't think Molly Darcy had crossed the Liffey in her life. She was an Artsider. And she said, "What number are you living in?" I said, "Number 5. That's the one with the green door. Has it still got a green door, son?" I said, "It has. How did you know that?" And she said to me, "Many's the time I took a message over there to the big fella." And I discovered later, from my mother, that she carried messages and coming them on. And she used to go over to Collins, and he stayed, and I eventually found the safe house was number 9, but she said he'd often go into number 5 and climb over the railings, come over the back walls into number 9. And she'd go over knocking at the doors looking for any second-hand clothes, man. She'd, if you like, beg second-hand clothes and sell them. And when she'd knock at number 9, she'd get some second-hand clothes, and as she took the clothes, she passed in the messages. And she said she used to carry them with her in the legs of her drawer, where the tans wouldn't even touch a woman down there.
What was the greatest piece of advice she gave you?
Well, I mean, Molly Darcy gave me so much of advice. Like, if worrying is going to help you, sit there and worry. That's why I have no grey hairs, Weezy. I don't do any worrying. It doesn't help.
And you haven't gone to barber for 50 years.
Oh, don't tell everyone that. Jesus. No, well, my mother cut all of it. We had 14 of us. And my mother cut her hair every Saturday night. And I started cutting my own hair every Saturday night. And, of course, now Jackie doesn't like the way I do it, so she'll often do it for me. So that's the way.
We're jumping around when you mentioned the hair.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, I was into Molly Darcy's sayings. Her sayings were that, you know, worrying is going to help worry, and it doesn't, so don't. It's better to wear out than rust out, meaning get up and do something, and don't be sitting around. And if you want something done, ask a busy person. The fellow lying on the couch looking at the television is too busy to do something for you. And we know what that means. So she said all those things to me, and many, many more. And we put in the commercial now, we should. If everyone buys the book, they learn an awful lot about success and the tips for to get there.
You can be sure. And by the way, talking about, rumour has it you have another book in the offering.
Yes, I have. I have another couple of books being worked on, and there'll be a new one out for September of next year.
What will that one cover?
It'll cover aspects of my life, in business in particular, that I glossed over in the book. I didn't have time. I wrote the 600 pages originally in that. It's 460 now. So we've another book in the context of the business side of my life in the later years. Most of that is around my earlier years. I've another one on health, Rishi. I think Molly Darcy's saying that everyone knows is your health is your wealth. And it's no point having money if you're not healthy enough to enjoy it. And I like to think that I'm very, very healthy. I work very hard at being healthy. And I'm trying to pass the tips that she gave me and the things I've learned on health on in one of the next books will be about health.
What's the most important part of trying to keep healthy?
Well, the first thing is having a positive outlook on life. That's the first thing. And the other thing is exercise and what you eat and drink. Bum, 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 bum. Those four things.
Eating, very important.
Eating's very important. And Molly Darcy used to say something, and that's turned out for true. We used to have our dinner at lunchtime and our tea at 6 o'clock in the evening. She'd never read after 8 o'clock at night. And that's one of the habits that probably got us into things like colon cancer and all that stuff, by eating very, very late at night and having food when you're asleep.
What would upset you? Are you an emotional person? What would bring tears to your eyes?
Well, I can tell you this much. Writing that book brought a lot of tears to my eyes when I thought of all, what would you say, when you realise how much your parents have done for you, Evie. And we don't realise that till they're gone. And it's probably fair to say that. We probably didn't have the acumen to say thanks for all that. So that book is a tribute to my mother, and I'm saying it now.
You mentioned your grandmother, Molly Darcy. She lived to be 100. I was lucky enough last Sunday night to be at a birthday party in Killarney, where there was 250 people present for a woman, Nora Keane from Castlevine. She was celebrating her 100th
Fantastic.
And she finished up tonight dancing the floor, and I had to go away home and go to bed because she was dancing.
Well, you see, that's the kind of health that we have to try and emulate, Weishi. And these people live very simple lives, very simple eating and drinking habits, very interested in everything that's going on around them, and always go for their walks and take their exercise. You'll find that that's, those four things are in most people's regime who live to be 100.
I know that your motivational skills has touched a good few people, and I know in particular Tyke Fox, who works with Radio Kerry and is a very close friend of yours. He tells me that even talking to you motivates Tyke a lot.
Well, you know, like me granny said, I always keep busy, and I always have a half a dozen projects going at one time. So when Tyke is talking to me about this and the other, I'm able to give opinions and all sorts of things. So he finds it very inspiring, as he said. But that's what comes from being busy, you know. The great thing about life that I find is action. I don't want to sit around reading. I don't want to sit around doing anything. I want to get out there and do things. So even though it's fair to say that I've achieved a certain amount of success in my business career, I still have my five-year plan going all the time. And all the time I'm adding to it. Like now I've added, I'm going to write three more books. But I still want to get 10% of the Irish market for Renault. I still want to grow the company. I still want to train young people in the business and give them the skills and the experience that I've picked up. And I want to develop the charity, the Irish Youth Foundation. We raise about $1.5 million a year at the moment. I want to raise that to $5 million a year if I can. There's lots more things I want to do with that money and helping disadvantaged youths all over the country. There's lots of projects that we could get involved in. And I saw a few of them today, even out in Clorgan. There's always things to be done. There's 8 schools up in Finglas in Dublin that don't have a computer, really. And I'm out, you know, Clorgan are lucky in having it. The Department of Education don't supply them. So you have to find the resources to get that into them, and we have to find a way of doing that. So I've always something going, and I think people find that excitement when they're with me, that I'm always thinking of different things.
You touched on the Inner City Youth Foundation there, and people mightn't realise, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though the book has been an international bestseller, all the profits of that are going into the Youth Foundation.
Of course, the Irish Youth Foundation, we've raised $200,000 so far.
What are the Irish Youth Foundation?
The Irish Youth Foundation is a charity, is a money-raising charity that Norma Smurfit founded in 1984. And what we do is we hold 5 or 6 events every year that raise about 500,000-700,000, and we tap into Corporate Ireland to give us donations, and we then find projects all over the country that need money, can't get it anywhere else off the government or whatever, and we have a team of research people who look at the project, assess it, evaluate it, and if we give the money, monitor it and make sure the money has been used right, correctly, and if we find a project that really works, we try and replicate it around the country. My best example that I could give people is very simple. In a certain area in Dublin in 1990, there was a lot of joyriding going on, cars being stolen, burnt out, kids being killed. And we met with the school and we said, we need to start something that has the kids' attention between 2:30 and 6:30. 2:30 when they finish school, 6:30 when the parents come home. We started a marching band with 8 kids learning music. And that has been so successful. Within 2 years, the joyriding had all stopped. Everyone in the area wanted to join the band. Everyone in the area wanted to be able to take their trumpet home. And we ended up now that after 12 years, we've 150 children in that area who have got diplomas in music. There's 150 of them in the band. They won the All-Ireland Championship, the European Championship, and we're second in the World Championship. And the day one of those kids in his area gets his instrument to take home, means he's reached a certain level, his chest goes up, he has self-confidence. He's a marketable skill. He'll always be able to earn money playing a musical instrument, as everyone in Killarney knows. You'll get a few quid no matter where you are in the world if you can play an instrument. And it takes them on to the discipline of focusing on the rest of their studies. So that just gives you an example. And we founded that band. We gave them, whatever, 10, 20 grand a year. Buy the uniforms, buy the instruments, and keep them all motivated.
And you mentioned,
that's the kind of thing we do.
You mentioned Killarney, turning to a few bob or sound today. Sean Hurley, of course, who's sitting patiently recording the programme. Sean turns a few bob on the sound at night, and it's a great thing, isn't it?
It is. It's a marketable skill.
Yeah.
And I should say that here in Killarney, the Irish Youth Foundation have been very strong supporters of the project in Farvey to the tune of a 6-figure amount.
Yeah.
So, as I say, it goes all around. It's not visible. We don't do anything. We just find projects for disadvantaged kids that need funds, and we go out and raise it for them.
If the government came to you in the morning, they said, look, you're in charge of Ireland. What five projects or things would you do to improve the country in whatever way you think it should be improved?
Well, I have to say this, Weishi, that I think that the government in the past 5 to 10 years have done very well. There's probably problems on the horizon at the moment, but they're still spending an awful lot more year in and year out on the services. I suppose the big debate at the moment is about the health services. I think they should be listening to me and focusing on preventing diseases rather than curing them. They're putting a lot of money into the health services and we don't know where it's gone. It's not getting given better service. We've more people working in it, but we're not getting the end results. So I'd certainly say that we'd have to put more management skills into the health services. After all that, we need to manage our infrastructure. We need to continue to attract investment into Ireland. And there's no simple fix or solution to any of the problems we have today. I honestly think that we have some very good people up there in government, including John O'Donoghue from Carsaveen. And I don't think there's anything I could tell them that they don't know. It's having the wherewithal and having the will to do certain things is what's needed. You're in a system. You've got to look after your constituents. The TDs are too dependent on local politics, and that's the problem. And we need to get them focused on running the country, regardless of what the people in their own locale think.
Any visions of going into politics?
Never. Sir? No, thanks.
Local or national?
No, I'm past all that now. Yeah. I love doing what I'm doing with the youth of the country. And I think anything I can do to help there, I do it passionately. And that's the thing about me when you say about tying and inspiration. I'm passionate about the things I do. The whole structure is flawed in the context, as I say, of having to keep the locals happy when you get in as a minister.
Many people would say people like you are motivated by money.
No, definitely not. And I'll put that one to rest right now. I would never, ever, ever set any of my objectives to make money. I set out to achieve certain things which brought the rewards, monetary and otherwise. But in terms of success, I never, ever, ever said I wanted to be a millionaire. I never, ever said I wanted to have a helicopter. I said, I'm a car salesman. I want to sell more cars than anyone else. I said, I have my own dealership. Again, I want to sell more and give a better service than anybody else. I now want Renault to be the number one brand in the country, if I can achieve that. And that all, when you do that well, you get a reward for it. And that's the natural progress of business.
I went to Trout in the M2 and order, they read in the book, and it brought back a lot of memories to me. Captain Carlson, the Flying Enterprise. How did he come into your book, will you tell me? A ship sinking, how did that come into the book?
That it's reminiscent of the ship full of cars out in the English Channel at the minute,
yeah,
isn't
but
it?
That's a
lovely story because, again, it's a tribute to my mother. It's back to my mother. One of the things I noticed, I would have been about 9 or 10 at the time, and I was really good at the English. I was in the library, I was reading a lot, and my father was a very nice writer, and I used to practice my handwriting with him. But my mother had left school when she was 6. So she couldn't really read or write. She could work her way around the pictures. She read the newspaper, but she only read the pictures. And I started sat
by candlelight, I presume.
Well, we had the gas globes in the wall. Oh, yeah. Gas globes in the wall.
Yeah.
And she used to read under the gas globe, or at the fire. You'd be reading with the light from the turf. Mm. So I sat down and started teaching her to read bit by bit, quietly, when no one was around, because my father used to read the newspaper to her when she wanted to know what was going on. And he took great pride in that, and actually it became a little power thing with him. So quietly I taught my mother to read, and the first thing she read was Captain Carlson. That was the Christmas of 1952. It was over the New Year, and this ship in the Atlantic had listed. The crew were all taken off, some of them drowned. But captain of the ship, Kurt Carlson, tied himself to the wheel, and it was very dramatic because it was the first global news story. The planes flew out from Shannon to take the pictures, and some of them didn't even make it back. They ditched, but he still got the camera in, and this picture was on the front page of our newspapers. My mother read that out the first time ever she read anything. I said, okay, hold the phone, let's all have a listen, Ma's going to read the paper. And she read out the story of Kurt Carlson on the Flying Enterprise coming into the west coast of Ireland. And my father was very upset because he had now lost, if you like, his little PowerPoint of having to be able to read her the newspaper. She could read herself. But I always remember the ship was supposed to come into Baltimore in County Cork, and the salvage took said no, they'd have to share the salvage with Baltimore, they'd take it home to Plymouth, where they had their own yard, and they'd keep all the salvage. But 100 miles off the English coast, she went down. Never made it. And that was the famous. And Kurt Carlson, the captain, came to live in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And he lived there for the rest of his life afterwards.
Yeah.
And plenty of people knew him. He did indeed, yeah. He did. So that's Captain Carson's story in 1952.
And it's in the book.
And it's the it was the first big media story we've ever seen, you know.
Well, that's one of the reasons why it left an imprint.
And for me, it was the first time my mother read out loud to us all, and that she had achieved that standard of being able to read the newspaper. And I was very proud. Someone often asked me what was my best achievement. That was one of them.
You mentioned there, when you said to your mother, hold the phone a minute.
There was no phone. That's today's phrase, isn't it?
A lot of people listening to the program won't realise that you were reared in the
tenement. One room. We had one room.
Yeah.
And it was divided in half by a wire, and we had sugar sacks sewn together as sheets hanging over that like a curtain. Yeah. And then one half of it then was cut in two quarters.
Yeah.
So we had two quarters and one half. There was one quarter was the bedroom for the children, small bed, two small beds, one for the boys, one for the girls, all in together, three at the top, three at the bottom. The other quarter was where the door was, and my dad's bike and the turf and all the odds and ends of the household was there. And the other half was my mother and father's bed and the kitchen and living room and the whole lot. And that's the way we were. And you could hear everything.
Yeah.
And there was 13 of us living in one room. We had no light. We had no heat, except for the turf and the fire. We had no electricity. We had no sanitary facilities. So you had to bring up buckets of water from the yard all the time. You had to go down to the back of the yard for the loo. That's the way we were composed under the bed. We all know what that was like. And that's the way we lived.
What was the biggest disappointment in your life?
I suppose the biggest disappointment in my life was the failure of my first marriage. I was married for 6-7 years. And because I was spending too much time working, I lost that relationship. And I made sure I didn't make that mistake second time around, because Jackie and I are very close. We do everything together. We go everywhere together. And that's one of the things I say to anybody. Yes, you can strive for success, but you have to get a balance on that. And the balance has to be between your home life and your business life.
Of course,
and relationships are very important.
You're a grandfather.
I am. I have a 7-year-old and 3-year-old grandsons. And yeah. I'm spending much more time with them than ever I did with my own children, because I can now take the time out. I have my life pretty well planned, and I can take the time out to see them and see them a lot. Looking forward to seeing them now on Stephen's Day now in the house.
Who were your heroes? Or who are your heroes?
Well, I had lots of heroes. The sporting world, I had great heroes. Starting with Ronnie Delaney, winning the Melbourne gold medal in 1956.
I had him on
first talk. Did you? Well, Ronnie Delaney has inspired us in the inner city, and I think I said it in the book. We all became runners. I became Taz, a son of coaches. I ran everywhere. I wanted to be a runner. Emil Zatopek, 1952 in Helsinki. Won the 5,000 metres, 10,000 metres and the marathon. Never been done before or since.
Yeah.
Great runner. 1960, the Olympics in Rome, Cassius Clay. And people mightn't realise that I met Cassius in 72 when he was over fighting Al Blue Lewis up in Crow Park. Brought in by Johnny McCarthy, the Opel dealer from Fermoy.
And Buddy Shukru, the strongman from Killarney.
Correct.
The promoter.
That's right. But Johnny McCarthy put up the money.
He did. Yeah. And there was a book came out lately about that.
Well, I met Cassius and we talked about the 1960 Olympics, and he said he was destined to win the gold medal because he visited the Colosseum and he walked into the Colosseum and he heard everyone chanting his name in his mind. Because look at his name. His full name was Cassius Marcellus Clay, a Roman name. And he could hear everyone saying in his mind, "Hail Cassius." He knew he was destined to win the gold medal and go on to be a world champ.
How did he strike you, to speak to the media?
Oh, this man was charismatic. His sheer presence, the vibrancy from him, vibrancy, energized the man was. Absolutely fantastic. And it's sad to see him in his condition today. And come back to what I said about health. Cassius Clay was born exactly 1 month before me. He's a month older to the day. He was born on the 17th of January. I was born on the 17th of February of 1942.
But he was motivated to keep on fighting and motivated to win world championships. And the same motivation you have in your business, he had in his business, if you like.
And can I say that his motivation, we talked about money, he never went out to earn money. Cassius Clay went out to be the best boxer in the world. He went out to achieve that. And as we know, he never really tried to damage people or be damaged. Sting like a butterfly, flit like a bee. That's the way he used to do it, or vice versa, rather. And he used to do that. And, you know, a great hero to stand up. No, I'm not going to Vietnam. I'm not going to go out and kill people that I don't know, who never did anything on me. You go do it. That took an awful lot of courage. People say he was a coward to do that. I see the opposite. He gave up his career. His boxing career was stopped for 4 years.
That's right.
He stopped. He was in prison. The whole thing was dreadful. But he had the courage of his convictions, and I admired him for that. I think he was one of our great sporting icons.
In the political field, we'd say worldwide, who did you admire most?
Well, John F. Kennedy was a hero. He came to Ireland, as you know, in 1963, 6 months before he was shot. And I quoted in the book from his wonderful speech. If you ever want to read something that's motivating, get a copy of John F. Kennedy's speech to Dáil Éireann in June of 1963, when he said that Ireland had given so many geniuses to the world, from the creator Hoban, who designed the White House. The first Commodore of the American Navy was Barry, whose sword hangs in the Oval Office. George Bernard Shaw, he quoted from. And that's what he said, that the Irish have given so much to the world. The Irish saved civilization with the monks of the 7th, 8th, and 9th century, keeping all the knowledge, including on Inishfallen, and then bringing it out to Europe again. So John F. Kennedy was very, very special to me as a man and as a politician. And he also inspired us in the context of saying, there's an Irishman who has reached the very pinnacle of power in the world, the most powerful man in the world. And that inspired me, I know, at the time to say, hey, if he can do that, I can certainly become one of the best motor dealers in Ireland. And that was my objective at that time.
You reckon the darkest hours before the dawn. Is that one of your favourite scenes?
Yeah. You always have to be determined. And sometimes when you get overwhelmed with problems, one of the things that struck me out in Killargan this morning, Weishi, was that Joe O'Dwyer has built on the school property with his own money a meditation room. And that's very important, to be able to withdraw from all those the maelstrom of problems. And if you can't find a place to do it in your mind, where you can draw into a tranquil. I always, if I have problems and there's hurly-burly in the office, I'll close my eyes and imagine I'm up on Mangerton Mount looking out at the lakes, and let my mind cool down, calm down, and then I'll solve the problem.
I must add,
make a decision.
I must add into the program that last night you mentioned 1955 and you were on Croke Park
saying
things. Well, the captain of the Kerry team that day was a great John Dowling.
John Dowling.
John Dowling. Well, yeah. Last night in Terrace Talk, I had his six daughters and my guests in Terrace Talk last night, and it was they were explaining how their father, Larter Messon, had motivated them in sport. And each of the six of them, there was five of them with me, each of them had represented their country at basketball, motivated in a completely different way by the father. So you don't have to be a great son of a Kerry footballer to become great. Last night, they explained on Terrace Talk how they were motivated by their father. Nice story.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely. And that's, we all need a bit. Young people need motivation, and that's getting back to where we come in, Weishi, is that, yes, maybe it is time that the schools brought people like me and business success people around to give their story, and because we all have a different story. But the underlying current is still the same. It's 99% perspiration. And that's probably the one thing that I fear about the young people today. We had no expectations. My grandmother used to say, you know, son, we were poor, the neighbours were poor, but none of us knew we were poor. Yeah. And today, you know, we're spoiling children in many ways. They hold a hand out for everything and get it. And that's the drawback that I see, that going forward, you have to be prepared to get through tough times, because we all come through tough times, whether it's business, like, you know, the whole .com debacle and stock shares at the moment. You have to be able to ride through all that. Or whether it's on a personal basis, they're going to come up with problems. And they're not prepared for that. And I keep saying that the reason I was more successful than my peers was because I outworked them. I worked harder, I worked smarter, and I not because I wanted money, I wanted to do it better than them. And that's what sports gives you. You want to beat the other guys. Not because you've gotten against them. You just want to be better than them.
Yeah.
And you have to learn. 99% perspiration is what success is.
What's down the line for you? How long are you going to keep up the pace you're going at? Have you any notion of yourself and Jackie just retiring
We'll never retire. I've scaled back in terms of the frenetic pace I used to go at in Renault, because I now have a superb management team and they're able to run the company. I'm now the coach, I'm now the mentor, I'm now there to give them advice and guidance when they need it. But I've let them basically make the decisions now. In terms of what I want to do, we really enjoy travelling. We want to spend time with my grandchildren, and Jackie's son is married now as well, so we'll see what happens there. And we want to spend time in Kerry.
As we're coming to the end of our chat, Bill, it was absolutely fascinating. One part of the book, near the end of it, you quoted something, how a verse was found in your father's wallet after he died.
Golden Stockings.
You might tell the story of that, and as we're coming to the end of it, you might even read the verse for us, please, if you wouldn't mind.
Give me that for a minute. Well, the story is very simple.
That's very touching.
Yeah. In the tenements, as I said, it was cold, it was damp. There was no heat, so the winters were tough. And my mother lost two of her children at that time. The second child she lost was a girl called Betty, who would have been 2 years older than me. And she was taken up to the hospital, and she passed away. And in those days in Dublin, to avoid grief for parents, it was during the war, the Temple Street Hospital was run by nuns, and they used to just take the children away and bury them quietly somewhere. So we never knew where Betty was buried. So, you see here, my father was there, and I tell the story vividly about him seeing the little corpses getting taken away in a wooden cardboard box. So it says here, one small page was found in Billy McCullen's wallet after he died. So when my father died, I found this poem in his wallet, and it said, "Golden stockings you had on in the meadow where you ran, and your little knees together, bob like pippins in the weather, when the breezes rush and fight for those pimples of delight, and they dance from the pursuit, and the leaf looks like the fruit. I have many a sight in mind that would last if I were blind, many verses I could write that would bring me many a sight, but now I only see but one. I see you running in the sun, and the gold dust coming up from the trampled buttercup."
And one of your close advisors, of course, is a Kerryman, a man that won three county championship hurling medals.
You know him. Well, that man is Jackie's nephew. His father is Brendan Purcell out in Ballydove, and Jackie's his aunt. And yes, he's been a stalwart footballer and hurler and everything else down here in Kerry, but he's up in Dublin now, and he's working with us as marketing manager of Renault. So we're delighted to have Brian Purcell with us in Renault, and going forward in helping us in many ways and making sure that Renault get to the rightful place in the top three of motor sales here in Ireland.
Well, as we come to the end of our chat, I want to thank Tyke Fox for persuading you to take an hour out of your tremendously busy schedule. And of course, Sean Hurley, who's on sound today, always so helpful in the Killarney studio. And Bill Cullen, I want to thank you sincerely. It was an absolutely fascinating hour. Maybe it was longer, I don't know, because I lost track of the time, I tell you the truth. But the program will be gone out in the new year, and it was lovely to have you, and I want to thank you sincerely for coming into the Killarney studios and into Radio Kerry and coming on Terrace Talk and talking about your life.
I wish you, I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I want to wish everyone in Kerry a happy and prosperous new year. Thank you.